Welcome to Command Control Power, a weekly podcast hosted by three certified members of the Apple Consultants Network, drawing from over 30 years combined experience. We talk shop, interview vendors and colleagues, and share what we've learned while operating our technology consulting practices. This is Joe Saponari of CIMAC, and my two co-hosts are Sam Valencia of the HCS Technology Group and Jerry Zygmunt of MacWorks. We are live at commandcontrolpower.com, the first Tuesday of every month, where new episodes are posted weekly. Thanks for listening. We're very pleased this week to be joined by Pepin Brienne. Pepin is with Duo Security, and you're an R&D engineer with them, and you're based out of Ann Arbor, Michigan at this point.
That's here, snowy Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Excellent. Welcome to the show. We're very glad to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So you're obviously, as I mentioned, with Duo Security, and so you know you have a very security-minded mindset, and I want to kind of drill down into that a little bit, but let's start by talking a little bit about your backstory before we get into more current topics. How did you get into consulting?
My story is very similar to other Mac admins out there. Whether or not you know you're consulting or doing something else, the reason you ended up with Macs usually has something to do with some kind of creative use of computers, and Macs are pretty popular with that. I started in the music world. I went to school, did some music related stuff. I was with a bunch of other late teen, early 20 folks that tend to abuse computers quite a bit in their everyday, and I was kind of tired of the lab computers that we needed for assignments to always be broken. So I sort of started fixing things that people like to do. Like back in the day, you could record your own error beeps, and people would scream into a microphone and make that the beep on all the lab computers.
What a great idea. I never thought of that.
Oh, definitely not popular with the, I wouldn't say professors, but the people teaching the class. If every machine threw a beep and, 12 machines were screaming possibly obscenities at them instead of the regular beep. So I decided to keep that in order a little bit, keep things working. So they're actually tools and not toys. They kind of stuck. So I kind of hung around in that particular side of the computer fan. Macs really sank in with me. Like, this is a great experience. I love using these things for the immediate thing that I'm interested in, music and audio and things like that. But in general, just it was a much better experience. So before I knew it, I was, sort of like rolling into, hey, you know a little bit about these Macs. Are you interested in helping us out with a couple of these Macs here? And just kind of rolled into it that way. So, you always end up in some kind of creative environment. So I worked with quite a bit of creative environments, publishing environments, other print-related things. Later on, you get more like digital, web, and animation, things like that. So yeah, that kind of just, you roll into it really at some point.
So you were using things like Mark of the Unicorn and Pro Tools in its early days on OS 9 and that sort of thing?
Yeah. This was actually before that. Without dating myself, but if you can Wikipedia, you can figure this out. My first Mac was a Power Mac 7100 running. I had to upgrade it when I got it to System 761, so on floppy. It had a 20 meg hard drive. It was very expensive. So yeah, so that's kind of like how long I've been around. Yeah, so I used things like Performer before it was Digital Performer, and Logic before it was Logic Audio. So yeah, it's fun to see how that's grown and how little you need these days. You need just an iPad and that's it. Back in the day, you needed a lot more gear to make that happen.
That's pretty amazing. All you need is GarageBand and you're good to go, pretty much.
Right. Exactly.
I'm always curious to hear about people that have a musical background that come into IT. I see it so often. I mean, with our own Jerry, as well as a lot of people that I know in the business, that mind works well together. People of a musical background tend to fall into the technical background and end up with a career in it. It's just so amazing that how common that is throughout our industry.
For sure. And I think the creativity and the sort of looking for the right tools to get the job done when you're a lot of folks that are in the creative industry, whether it's visual or music or otherwise, they're really not necessary or often not interested in the technological background or reasons why something works. They just need tools that work really well. I always say, it's kind of a slogan that we have at my company as well, but we're not rock stars, we're roadies. We keep the tools, keep the pencil sharp and the brushes clean and dry, and we let the people who have the job to do actually do that job. So I kind of felt like that too early on. Like, I know the tools that everyone wants to use. I understand them. I know what you want out of them. So let me take care of keeping those tools basically fresh and sharp. Yeah, that creativity sort of really overlapped. Whether it's Mac consulting or administration, it's really this Mac IT is pretty much the same job. There's a lot of creativity. There's a lot of community, people working together. You know, it's kind of like a big jam session, really. We're all just sort of pitching in with the, you know, the bit that we know a little bit about to keep the music going, I guess.
That's a good way to look at it. Does it count? I listen to music in the background while I work. Part of
yeah, no, absolutely. It all counts.
Well, then I'm on board with that, too. I think it's a good good assessment. Well, I'm curious, Pepin, when you were, you know, back in school and trying to keep the tools in order back then, and all these systems are beeping and swearing and all this stuff, how were there any tools to like manage it? I mean, what was your move when you found that somebody changed the beep sound? Was there some kind of like low level thing in, you know, in System 7 you could do to lock that file or that preference? Or what was your approach, you know, to sort of administrating those Macs way back then?
Yeah, you know, obviously when you start out and back in the day, the machines themselves that were in use in the labs were really not managed, you know, in any way to begin with. So a lot of it was just one by one manually changing things. But yeah, I did a little bit of, once I figured out like, oh, I can lock files so that, you know, you can't touch this or you can't override that. So I did a little light bit of that. I definitely think it was a good way to early on learn to automate wherever you can. So once you've done the manual go around a few times, you sort of like remember that later in life. So, you know, once I did this a little bit and I got into environments that were a little more, you know, a little more organized, you know, you start working with the ASIP and all that stuff and you have a little more control over it. So yeah, but a lot of manual stuff in the beginning. It was just, that's what you have. Those are the things you got to work with. But it gave me a deep appreciation for automating wherever you can, because doing something manual too many times is just, you know, at least it gives me a headache.
Yeah. Well, it's the only way it scales anyway. So you definitely need some amount of automation. And I guess that, you know, even a fleet of a dozen Macs back then would give you that. Yeah, you'd learn that lesson real quick.
Real fast.
Yeah. I guess I was on the other side of things. But I was one of the kids, you know, first discovered, you know, Macintalk, and you could use HyperCard to tell the Macintalk voice to swear, you know, and that was just like pretty fun. And I mean, I joke, but like, honestly, like when I discovered you could get it to do things that were not, that didn't come with the computer, you know, it wasn't like out of the box, you know, you could program it essentially to do what you wanted. And that was just the first, you know, little kind of funny piece of the puzzle was like, oh, we can make the computer swear. That's funny. And then kind of moving on from there. That's what got me interested in why I think I spent all, you know, all those hours with computers along the years that got me so comfortable with them was they were sort of like malleable. You could program them, you could adjust them to the way you wanted to work. You could even develop, you know, in HyperCard, you could make stacks and you know, games essentially, or, you know, we used it for different school projects to, you know, basically like a early version, almost like a PowerPoint. And really it was a precursor to the web, in fact. So, you know, having the fact that those tools existed, you know, at first as a kid, you joke around with them, but they're real powerful tools. And it's an interesting way to kind of, I don't know, gain some experience. And I mean, look where it's got you all these years later, just way back then, keep people in line and keep the computers functioning as tools. That's it's a really interesting lesson. What a trajectory all these years later.
It's been an interesting ride for sure. So I, you know, still enjoy the platform. I still would not want to be anywhere else, I think.
So did you have a consultancy when you mentioned, like, you know, working with all these different companies and keeping the tools, you know, sharp and functioning and all?
I did. It always ends up like word of mouth. Like, you know, a friend who, you know someone who needs someone to come by a couple of days a week, and they'll just, you know, kind of pay you whatever. Later on, I did work for, not like a dedicated like Mac consultancy. It was just a larger like IT consulting business that sort of like, you know, a Robert Half type organization. And they placed me at a, you know, a number of interesting spots. So I'm from the Netherlands. That's where I grew up. That's where my early days in Mac administration were. I worked for the largest. They have a national broadcasting system there, which is just gigantic. It, you know, every network that broadcasts on the public airwaves is in one location in the country. So they have just huge facilities where a lot of TV is made. So I worked there for a while. So I learned at scale in a broadcast environment how to how to keep things going from like dedicated edit suites to just folks working with. I think I had some WordPerfect in there at some point, and you really get to learn the tools of the trade pretty quickly. So I did definitely some working for consultancies, and you get to see a lot of different environments and learn quickly. You learn to adapt to every time.
I want to focus on the fact that you're from the Netherlands. I had no idea. So when did you come over to the States?
I've been here permanently since about 2003. So I've been here about coming up on 15 years now. I back and forth, but I've been here steadily since about 2003.
Nice. And what part of the Netherlands are you from?
Well, I was born in Rotterdam, so, harbor city. I grew up more in the middle parts of the country. In Holland, middle or east or west or south is kind of relative.
Yeah, right.
It's about an hour in any direction. But yeah, that's sort of where I got my my start. And, Macs are a lot more expensive outside of the States, too. So just to remind everyone, that first 7100 came at a premium back in the motherland.
Hey, Papine, I'd really like to get into the Mac Admins conversation and learn more about how you got into that podcast and working with the guys like Tom and Charles and Emily, and knowing more about how that all got put together, what you feel like your role is and what your audience looks like these days.
Yeah, so it's been one of those organic things that kind of like started with, hey, you want to try this out? So, let's see, what are we at now? We're about like 2.5-ish years or so since the macadmins.org Slack was put up. This was John Kitzmiller. He was kind of tired of IRC just sort of being not a very user-friendly way to get new folks in the Mac admin scene. And Slack was heavily promoting their goods. So he decided, let me just put this up to make it a little easier to talk to the direct people that I want to talk to, and we'll see where this goes. So smash cut to, 2.5 years later, when we're close to 15,000 users now. I think the stats are, on any given day, we have about 3,500 actively talking folks, and then, a lot of people reading and et cetera, et cetera. So it grew into a huge community of just, really Mac administration, sysadmin focused people. And that really is a very wide, audience. It is, consultants like yourself. It is people in, sort of like one person shops. It's all the way up to folks who work at Google and Facebook and manage tens and tens of thousands of Macs. And it's a really, really nice community. Everyone, there's a lot of collaboration going on. There's a lot of folks working on projects that augment the larger tools that are out there. We have, a friend of your and our show, Alan, on there as well from Watchman Monitoring, who really seems to use it to his advantage of reaching out to folks as well as, helping the community out. So it really grew into a very, I feel like, rare for large, global communities on the internet. Before you know it, it sort of turns into a less than friendly operation. But this has really stayed very collaborative and very, very friendly. We kind of were like, everyone has a podcast these days. Most people have at least two or three that they're personally involved in. Can we do something? And I think it was actually Charles Edge who just sort of tweeted it like, hey, if we were to start like a Mac Admins focused podcast, who would be interested? So I raised my hand and said, absolutely, I'd love to do that. That sounds actually like a fun thing to do. And Tom chimed in, Emily joined us, Marcus Ransom, James Smith these days, and Adam Kadiga as well. Everyone sort of like joined in, and we kind of established like a rotating cast of people that can join, not every episode, but every, couple of episodes. Others like me and Tom and Charles and Marcus often, join every week, but it's kind of like a loose rotating cast. And we just started recording. That's really, I think, when you do a podcast, you just got to get some reps in. You just start recording and listen back to it, get feedback from folks, go with that, what you hear, and change some things and get into a flow and get into a regular pace. There's lots of guests to get. We don't have any problems getting people to talk about, whether it's EDU or small shops, big shops, tools they're working on, open source tools, commercial tools. There's still so many people that we need to have on that we have, at least a year and a half or two where we can just, have someone else on the show every week and dig further into the large field that is Mac sysadmin practice. It's been a real fun opportunity, really.
So help me understand the whole Mac admins aspect of it. So people think of Mac admins in a couple different ways. People think of it as the podcast, and then, that's how some people know it. And then, of course, the Slack. We always have to prefix it with the, because you guys have a Slack team, Mac admin. Yep. And that's what everybody, when people say the Slack, they're talking about your Slack, the Mac admin Slack. And so what is Mac admin? Who is that and what is it? Pretend I don't know.
When I think about it, it's like, what is what? Who is on what? So it's sort of like a term that grew over time. And, you know, when you need to hashtag everything, it's handy to have something to hang your hat on. So macadmins.org was founded. So John Kitzmiller established that essentially. So he got the domain. It was available. He slid the Slack under that domain as well. And, you know, we worked with him and said, hey, we want to do the podcast. Would you be cool with hosting that for us? He said, absolutely. It's a good collaboration of just a bunch of folks from the community. I guess like well-known people that talk at conferences that generally speaking, like have sort of a forward, attitude about sharing knowledge and trying to help out new folks in the community. It's really not much of a official entity, I guess, but a domain that has a couple of things that fall under it. We try to keep it real, sort of easygoing, and not a lot of, we don't have a lot of, there's no board meetings or, things like that. We just keep it nice and easy and just let the community sort of like take over, get its free money's worth out of it.
So you guys are kind of the anonymous of Mac consulting.
Yeah, in all the right ways.
Right, exactly. Only for good.
Nice.
Exactly.
So, Pepin, what do you do as an R&D engineer for Duo Security?
For me, this was an interesting move. So up until about a year and a half ago, I was, living the Mac sysadmin life. My last position before I started here, sort of in a non-sysadmin position, was at the University of Michigan in town here. Worked up there for about 3 years, and that was definitely the largest fleet that I was tier 3 engineer for. So it was the idea was, engineering larger scale solutions for, for managing many thousands of Macs. So they were implementing Duo as a two-factor authentication layer on top of the regular systems that they run there. In the process, I kind of got to talk to some people that work at Duo. They're also in town. They just kind of invited me over and said, hey, we might be, interested in having you, for a role. We don't know quite yet what might be a good fit. To their credit, they, they just had me in and sort of like with an open mind, had me interview with the various folks on the different teams. I was then offered a position on the Duo Labs team, which is the research and development arm of Duo. So it's kind of the folks that get to break things and then write up how they broke it and then how to fix it or make it better. In that position as an R&D engineer, I get to sort of bring my Mac background and everything that I've learned over the years in small shops, big shops, chaotic shops, very well organized shops, as sort of a piece of the puzzle that we're trying to work on to have various folks with all different backgrounds, whether it be iOS or Android or hardware hacking or cryptography. So we kind of all just mesh together and work on projects that seem important. So in that regard, I get to do a lot more long-term research. So we just recently wrapped up a research into Apple's EFI, where we kind of like looked at what has Apple shipped over the course of like about 3 years or so since 2015. Do those updates always get applied properly and expectedly because it's silent? How can you know that it didn't apply? What are the risks of having vulnerable EFI, et cetera? So I get to do sort of like these longer term projects, crunch a lot of data, look at a lot of things and, come up with hopefully smart things to say about it. It's a different way of being involved with the Mac platform, but I enjoyed it a lot because I like taking things apart. So in that regard, it's fun to dig into the OS and do a lot of like reverse engineering and figuring out how a thing works and then coming up with something to say about it or just, generally speaking, improving the security picture overall. And in case of the EFI research, we work with Apple very closely. And they, they gave us good feedback on, what we come up with. And since then, I think they've made some changes there too as well. Not necessarily directly based on what we did, but it seemed like we helped the larger community out there get visibility on this particular thing of the platform. So that's the fun thing. That's really a different role than, making Macs, keeping them going and fixing things and chasing bugs. But it's fun to do the research part. So, that was an interesting or just a different thing to do in my career. It was a real, like a move where it was like, it seems a little scary, but that's probably a good thing. Like if it's a little scary, it's probably a good thing to try out. I'm just having a blast. I've done so much in the last year and a half that it's amazing. I do not have a dull moment.
It sounds pretty exciting that you might be the first person to, you know, to be in certain areas exploring the firmware, you know, exploring the EFI and, you know, understanding like how it works. There's probably not, I mean, obviously for good reason, there's probably not a lot of documentation that's public. And probably Apple themselves don't necessarily have the same level of low-level experience with it. You know, I mean, I think that they run pretty lean as far as number of engineers working on any given area. So they're probably not devoting a ton of resources to their own low level. It's EFI, the extensible firmware interface. So it's like, I always think of open firmware, like setting an open firmware password. Yeah, that was the old, the old way. So EFI relates to very fundamental sort of like boot up sequence of the Mac. How should we think about like what else that relates to?
Yeah, so as we like to say, or I had to come up with one of the slides in our presentation that we've given a few times now. If you don't want to know, you know, all nitty gritty details about it, how should you see this? And it really is, EFI is the starter motor in your car. Your engine usually doesn't turn over by itself unless it's very old and you can push it. But generally speaking, nowadays, car engines have a starter motor, or if you have an electric car, well, then it's a whole different story. But it needs something to kick the actual engine in motion. So EFI is the very first thing that kicks in when you turn on the power. It's a mini OS. So it's a tiny OS, but it's very important because it lives at a very low layer below the kernel, below the OS, below the applications that run on it. So if you're an attacker and you can get into that EFI early on, as we've seen with ThunderStrike 1, ThunderStrike 2, et cetera, you have full visibility of everything. You have full visibility of full disk encryption, file vault 2, you know, you laugh at that point. You can inspect every bit of memory, every bit of disk. So it's not visible. Folks don't really know it's there. The only real reason you know it's there is when you use netboot. So when you hold down the N key, EFI actually shunts you to a different part in EFI and goes and looks for a netboot server. But that's still part of it.
The boot option screen, right, would also be technically from EFI. But but it looks like you don't even notice it because it looks like the current interface. But I think what you're saying about the netboot is more like you see like, well, this is really old code. You have these carbon level borders around buttons and things and like this really old stuff. It's really interesting. So that's still hanging around after all these years, some of that code. Huh?
It's still there. And the funny thing is that you hear a lot as of late about the Intel management engine or Intel ME being just, well, we'll call it a tire fire to be nice. That is another part that in non-Mac PCs is also a part of the system that also always runs. You don't really know about it, but if you can get into it, you have, you know, super user view of everything. So there's a lot of these low-level systems that, you know, your average user and even admins don't necessarily know about, but they're very important to keep up to date. And so that was fun. I got to research that and kind of like make a big spreadsheet in Google Sheets, which turns out when you make them real big, they get really slow. You know, imagine that. And then we kind of like did a lot of number crunching and comparing things, et cetera. So that was a real fun thing to do. And it ended up, I think, being a real good thing for the community because more and more folks are now using things like OS Query and other tools to get that visibility and say, hey, I have, you know, 10% of my fleet is not at the version it should be. So let me remediate that. So that's kind of the goal that we had, you know, research it, write it up, and then offer some solutions to, you know, to make things a little better.
I've seen some of your blog posts on Duo.com site, which our listeners should check out for sure, because there's some very interesting and intriguing information that's there, security related information. But you're talking about, let's just talk about an operating system that you're running, whether it's Sierra or High Sierra. You're going to be of the recommendation to patch it with the latest security fixes as soon as they come out, of course, right? To make sure that you're up to speed. Would you also be of, I guess this could be dependent of your situation or your organization, but would you also be of the mindset of always update your operating system to the latest version? Obviously, you need to vet it for your industry or for whatever applications that you're running. But how's your feeling on OS updates, provided all things being equal and your applications can support it?
So you're saying like always stay at the latest that Apple ships, for example, versus the latest update for what might be a previous version?
Yeah, obviously, a security update is a good idea on whatever operating system that you're running. But would you be inclined, let's say in your environment, to upgrade to the latest OS, like when High Sierra releases, immediately after release?
Yeah, so obviously we've had a bit of a couple of weeks here with Apple not giving us very good vibes about immediately jumping on every update that they come out with. But that said, the way Apple patches issues in the OS, it's sort of like it's an unwritten, we know that Apple supports current and then minus two OSs. So 10.13 is current right now. They'll send out security patches for 10.12 and 10.11. But the fixes that you get between, let's say, a 10.13.2, a security update 2017.001 for 10.12 and for 10.11, the contents of those will not necessarily be the same. So Apple, for example, in 10.12 patched Broadpwn, the Broadcom Wi-Fi chip vulnerability where you could get code execution under Wi-Fi chip. Awesome. Nothing wrong with that, I'm sure. But they didn't patch it in 10.11 or 10.10 when 10.12 was still current at the time. And they didn't really announce that. You kind of had to go into the security release notes and kind of like suss it out yourself. Like this particular bit is only for 10.12. That is for 10.11 and or 10.10. So it kind of goes back to, what is your threat model, to use an InfoSec buzzword? What is your threat model? If you have a lot of users that walk around with laptops, your Facebook or Google, then your threat model is a lot more restrictive and will have a lot more things on it, nation states wanting to get into your infrastructure, than you're an accounting firm, a local accounting firm, and you mostly have desktops, and your biggest concern is people clicking on phishing links that they shouldn't. Given that, I would always say update to the latest OS, the newest version of the OS that's available, do your due diligence. So as a Mac admin, I think a big job that you have is being on the beta program, spending that $100 a year, being on the beta program, testing this out early on so that you can both know for your internal operations that things will be okay once it comes out. And of course, Apple can always throw you a curveball as we find out. And you can go to vendors and say, hey, listen, this piece of software that you ship is not currently compatible. We're still 2-3 months away from this going live. We can usually guess like mid to late September. Start working on fixing that for us. File bugs, et cetera, et cetera. If you don't do that and you just wait for it to come out and just, sort of have a YOLO mode of rollouts, yeah, you're going to feel the pain. You can definitely do yourself a lot of favors by doing the beta testing and sort of getting ahead of the curve. But I would say go to the latest version wherever possible, because of Apple's tendency to only fix certain things in what they're currently shipping. And that's, that's up to them. They have no deals with anyone to always patch it across N-2 or just the current version. The quickest way to be sure that whatever is out there, big bad stuff is out there, is patched, is being on the latest. It can be tough. But if you want stability and you cannot, physically go to, let's say, 10.13 because some very important bit of software is broken still, stick on that, install the security updates, but stay on the vendor that has the software, whether it's Apple or a third-party vendor, to get this fixed ASAP, because it's going to run out at some point.
I mean, another answer to Sam's question is the way, Sam, you answered my question, I think it was last week or the week before, when I said, is it better to, like, as a rule of thumb, wait for 0.3 of an OS? I don't know where I got that idea, but it seemed like a lot of esteemed colleagues over the years had always kind of said, I always wait for the 0.3, or that's just generally when I start recommending it to clients. And Sam's point was very valid, which is like, it kind of just depends, you don't really know anymore. And I think that to your point about Apple not really offering any guidance that's published anyway about what their actual policy is, it's just really tough to actually write our own policies around that, because they just don't have a strict, sort of guideline. Like if we were staying up to date because we want to get all the latest software updates and security updates, that actually made us vulnerable to this recent root blank password issue.
I am root.
Yeah, that only affected 10.13. So if you were cutting edge there, yeah, you got all the latest security updates that may not have been shipped for previous versions, but you were also silently susceptible to this 0 day. So it's really tough. I mean, one interesting exercise is to go to the Wikipedia page and look at release versions of the last release version of all of the OSs of Mac OS X. And if you see like early days, they got to like the 3 or 4 version. And then there was kind of a sweet spot where they stopped releasing so quickly. And in 10.2, 10.3, 10.4 era, even 10.5, you know, they got up to 10.411 with Tiger. That gives them an awful long time to like fix a lot of stuff and get the OS to be really, really stable. 10.5.8, questionable. 10.6.8, a lot of people say the last good Mac OS was Snow Leopard. You know, they got up to the 0.8 of that, you know, and then now lately it's they get to like the 0.5 or the 0.6 if we're lucky. I don't know what that says exactly, but to me it's a proxy for like how much development time are they actually able to devote to these. And by sticking to their own arbitrary, you know, yearly release cycle, you know, there's only so much they can do. I mean, there's definitely bugs that just exist and will exist for all time, and they just never get fixed. And there's probably security vulnerabilities that, you know, likewise that are there. I don't know what the takeaway is other than it's really hard to make a policy around this. Like, how do you determine, you know, is it better to run the previous one or the current one? It's just anybody's guess.
You know what I say? 10.3, 10.4, whatever it takes. I think it's silly to chase the numbers, you know.
Yeah,
you might as well use it.
I think we're in agreement. Yeah, I think that basically, like, who the heck knows anymore with this stuff? And like you said, I mean, Papine, you said basically, like, it depends on the threat model. And I think that's the first place to start is, like, what are you afraid of? What is the biggest concern for your organization?
Exactly. I mean, if downtime because of a bad update that breaks basic things like authentication and file vault and Open Directory, that never happens. If that is your biggest goal, then yeah. You want to take it slow. But I was also going to say, I'm personally of the opinion that this annual update model that Apple is now on, and they have, you know, all these streams of the platforms all aligned on top of each other. It's just one big, you know, seven-layer dip of OS releases. That annual update cycle is too short for macOS, in my opinion. It is too short. They need to cram too many features in there and, you know, parity with iOS to make sure that pictures you took on your iPhone still work on your macOS device. So I understand the need to keep feature parity, but doing these full OS, you know, full version cycles in you know, really under a year, because, you know, you have the beta period in which they don't really make a lot of changes anymore other than trying to get it ready to go out. It is too short. It really is. I understand marketing and PR, and it all looks great when you can announce it all at once. But with 10.13, we're now really seeing this taking hold of like this short development periods where things like iamroot just fly right by QA because they made major changes to Open Directory, File Vault with APFS. They needed to, you know, cram it all in there and then forgot to see if service accounts are affected by this opportunistic upgrading of accounts, because that seemed like a good idea. If you are out of cycles to test that, you're going to run into trouble, as we saw.
Right. And they've already had to adjust their release by, you know, pulling APFS support for spinning disks. And that wasn't part of the original plan. So it, clearly they just stuck with the deadline and cut things. And probably some of the things they cut were some QA. So it's just, I mean, as an outsider, you know, to the extent that we are, it just seems like this forced, rushed process that just does not need to be rushed. Like, nobody's telling them you have to release Mac OS every year. I mean, sure, release new Macs, focus on hardware, but release a new photo format as the default on the iPhone. So obviously with iOS 11, you know, that's the default. So they need support on the Mac, but like, what do you just make it a point release, right?
Nothing wrong with that. I mean, you can, over time, we've seen plenty of, you know, back when QuickTime was still the thing we all looked at for our codecs and whatnot, we got some updates sometimes. Things were incrementally, you know, made better. But this focus on having to have this big release that they can show at WWDC, and then in the fall, we can roll it all out. You're giving yourself more headaches by rolling it all out together, because all your support infrastructure needs to now suddenly gear up to support iOS, macOS, tvOS, watchOS, it all comes out at the same time. That just seems like, for the sake of artificial newness, you're giving yourself a lot of headaches. And I'm hoping, really hoping, that this sort of hell week that they had with having to rush out updates for both iOS and macOS because things were just missed in pretty embarrassing ways is giving them some pause as far as, like, do we really need to do this thing with, especially with macOS? They're in a, you know, I think in a pretty good stride as far as iOS every year, new models, etc. But for the macOS, I don't think it's necessary. And it there seems to be a lot more focus now on getting into enterprise more. They, you know, they had some announcement that enterprise has done the best in quite a few years, and they're trying to get, you know, more folks out on the enterprise sales path as well. you need to have a product that actually enterprise wants to implement. And if the story to enterprise is, yeah, we may have a week where it's you know, complete chaos and everything is on fire, but you know, you can deal with that, right? It's like, no, that's the opposite of what we deal with. We do not deal with fires.
Well, not to mention in a best case scenario, you've got like an enterprise sales cycle where you're writing an order for, you know, hundreds or thousands of machines of mm-hmm. a certain make and model with a certain OS, and you're designing your whole, you know, workflow and infrastructure around an OS. And then, you know, well, you can't get that at OS anymore. We just updated and,
right.
you know, now they ship with the new one. So good luck. You've got to now shoehorn that into your plans. And it's just, yeah, it's like a core kind of, you know, fundamental mismatch of the way Apple works with the way enterprise wants to work, I think, in a lot of ways. I mean, that said, Apple's doing great. You know, they're selling a lot of Macs. Like, this isn't, you know, they're not hurting over this, but it certainly, like, would probably not do any harm and could only serve to benefit them to slow things down, at least on the Mac side. And maybe it's every 2 years, you know, just every 2 years they kind of get back on the same cycle. But in the meantime, the Mac gets just the basic updates to update core image or whatever it would be, allow them to deal with whatever you've added to the iPhone and iPad. You know, that's their focus. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, I think you're right. Hopefully they got scared into doing this a little bit more, you know, sensibly.
I'd be curious to see if that actually happens. They should call the next operating system Snow High Sierra and leave it at that for a while.
Yeah, we haven't had a no new features release in like 10 years. I mean, we're just like well overdue for that. We had they updated the file system like that. You know, that's the opposite of no new features. So,
but if they don't do a yearly update, the media is going to cry foul and they're going to say that they're letting the Mac wither on the vine and they want everybody to run iPads. That's why they're compelled. They've already dug this hole that they can't get out of.
So we all noticed this announcement from Apple today that, surprise, we patched AirPort firmware. The surprise about it was that, I don't know, many of us were under the impression that when the crack vulnerability dropped, Apple was somehow known to be unaffected in some ways. And I think that was on a device level. Like, I think that devices, you know, iPhones, Macs were not immediately susceptible to it. But then there was also, I thought that I read that the AirPort Extreme and other AirPort devices were not vulnerable to it. So what am I misunderstanding about this? Because they just patched the vulnerability today.
It's a pretty funny, well, if you call, you know, wide-ranging Wi-Fi vulnerabilities funny. So the story is here is that we'll go back a little bit. So Apple patched in iOS 11, well, somewhere before 11 too, in any case, they patched, they rolled out some patches, and part of that, they added some language about having patched crack, or as they call it, key reinstallation attack, for very specific models. They patched it for the iPhone X and for the iPad Pro. And a lot of us looked at that and said, what does that mean? Does that mean those models were the only ones affected? Were those that suddenly were affected because you ship a certain chipset or software, or what's going on? Hmm. So then they had to do the rushed weekend rush out of iOS 11.2, and suddenly the security release notes got updated and said, hey, surprise everyone, now we also patch everything else that was not iPhone 10 or iPad Pro, to which everyone said, you what now? So you're telling us that all these machines prior to 11.2 were vulnerable to some level of crack. And Apple said nothing else other than, well, the words speak for themselves. So there was already a bit of like, okay, so these things were all vulnerable. Apple has just chosen not to patch them because, you know, it's very possible that they needed QA time, a crazy thing that is, to actually test this, to actually make sure that the patches that they put in there were actually good to go. So that's unclear. We don't know why they patched the newest, you know, iOS devices and then retroactively patched it for the older ones, iPhones 8 and earlier, up to like 5S, I believe. Forget the exact range. So same thing here with the AirPort base station. So they patch quite a few, you know, models of these, quite a few generations of these. The funny thing is that when, I should step back, it patches crack of about two or three different CVEs. It also patches, if you look closely, it also patches Broadpone, the previous, you know, earth-shattering Wi-Fi vulnerability, which, in my opinion, is a little more scary because it allows you to get remote code execution on the Wi-Fi controller. So how it works is that a lot of these systems are sort of like self-contained Wi-Fi systems with a little processor, et cetera, that are in a phone, in a computer, and also in access points that take care of all the Wi-Fi. So they, you know, they take care of all the work that is involved in handling Wi-Fi. I made sort of like a list for myself of like, well, Broadpone affects seemingly, it seems like these models and up of Broadpone chipsets. And in my list, I actually had airport base stations in there, but I was like, well, you know, depends. Those are quite different systems. They, you know, they're hardware systems. They have different firmware. They, you know, they might very well not be susceptible. And then when nothing came out, I was like, well, I guess that makes sense that they are, you know, sort of like not vulnerable. Now we're finding out that, whoops, we're using, you know, Broadcom chipsets in these access points, and they are indeed vulnerable not only to Broadpone but only crack as well. So it kind of feels a little weird, like they knew about this but they didn't say anything. And you know, you have your, you know, your security disclosure periods, but that was kind of up when Matty Van Hoof, who you know, for his PhD found all these vulnerabilities, you know, published his materials and his you know, proof of concept and etc. So at that point, Apple, you know, I would have expected to have some story of like, well, we're working on these are, you know, vulnerable or not. Obviously you can be quiet about it and hopefully, you know, no one will go look for it, but still it's a little concerning that it took this long and it has this long of a, you know, sequence of current and older airport access points that are vulnerable. So please update your base stations, because this is not good. This is like two really bad vulnerabilities rolled into one, and you want to patch that as soon as possible.
So you can only speculate, but I wonder how that works, because by everything that we've read, they disbanded the airport team some time ago. So what is it? They call everybody in a room and they go, hey guys, let's get the band together just one last time.
Yeah. I imagine this to be like, you know, straight from a movie. It's like you thought you were out and they pull you back in, right. You know, there's an Apple man in black who shows up at your door with a suitcase. It's like, you know, it's time. We need you back.
A really good album.
Yeah. Just one more time. Just one more going away tour. So yeah,
like the Hoop farewell tour again.
Again. Exactly. But yeah, they had to patch it. So however they got it done.
It's something doesn't quite add up, because I don't know if there's ever an official statement that was attributed to Apple. And certainly somebody at Apple could have just been misinformed, or they didn't know they were vulnerable or something at that mm-hmm. time. But I remember like right away in the news, I told clients like that it was okay, you know, and then things got patched and it's like, well, okay, well, I was going on bad information. So I really still wonder what, you know, what the story really was, and we may never find out. One curious thing about it is I remember reading about, at least with the crack one, it was difficult to, you know, to actually like, I don't know, take advantage of this vulnerability. It was, you know, not an easy hack kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder, like, when you say it's not an easy hack, what's difficult about it? Because it seems to me whatever, you know, level of, you know, understanding and difficulty you need for most, you know, like most attacks can basically just be like put into a little fun little script and added to, you know, they have these tools for hackers, right, where you just download this program that can run a pen test on a machine or just try a bunch of different things and take advantage of these. Like, what's difficult about executing something if it can't just be put into like click a button and then wait and then you'll be on the network, you know?
Well, with, you know, with this particular vulnerability, and the good thing is this, it's fresh again, still in my memory, because I was just at Black Hat Europe this past week, where actually the author of the study, Matty Van Hoof, actually presented it again and sort of like updated it for, you know, things that have happened since then. And, you know, he had a whole section about, you know, counting the ways in which people on the internet were wrong about my actual discovery. So that was nice. So he pointed out that, you know, it really depends on the vendor and also the device, you know, how big of a vulnerability and how big of a risk you run here. So it definitely, you know, stands to reason here to say that, you know, early on it was kind of like, if you patch just one side, if you patch your access points, it'll all be, you know, negated, it'll be safe. But that's not the case. You actually need to patch both clients and access points. You can't, you know, just go, I'll just do the one that's easier and then we're good. You want to do this all around. So the you know, sort of the insidious part of this is because it is Wi-Fi and because it deals with radio, make this. So it's a really complicated, you know, four-way handshake, you know, cryptographic story where at certain points in that process, the vulnerability or the bugs essentially in the protocol allow you to basically swap out a key that you don't know as an attacker with one you do know. And once you have a key that you know, part of the process of signing, you know, various bits of information later on, you can now decrypt that and you can, you know, do what you must, whether it's decrypting raw, you know, network traffic or, you know, get a hold of other parts of the, you know, general network communications, because you can do it from quite a distance. He spoke about having some folks having, you know, being able to do this across, like, you know, several miles of distance with, you know, a specialized antenna. You can make this happen from, you know, across the street or down the street for, you know, a target that you want to get into. So you don't need to be on site. I don't need to walk into, you know, let's say a Google office to make this happen. I can stand outside on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan. I'm going to look a little goofy with a gigantic directional Wi-Fi antenna, but, you know, I can put it in a van or something. Right. I can make this happen. So that is the insidious part of this, because you can affect such a low level of the early you know, protocols that are part of Wi-Fi, you know, authentication and encryption negotiation. You can get in there, and you know, it's impossible to tell if I'm a network administrator to see that someone is doing this. So that is the insidious part of that, and that makes it. Different systems have different ways where you can get in. Some, you know, you can only get maybe like a password or a passphrase out of the stream and then use that to, you know, do another attack on some other system once you have someone's passwords. Other implementations, you, like I said, you can just start sniffing unencrypted network traffic flows because you now have a known key and that you can use to decrypt certain traffic again. So it is a pretty complicated vulnerability, which is why it's important and Apple patches this on, you know, their entire fleet, iOS, macOS, and hardware that they sell. If it has, you know, a Wi-Fi chip in it and it does WPA2 in some way, it needs to be patched.
Agreed. Well, thank you for the explanation. Yeah, that does sound pretty insidious if basically it allows you to sniff traffic from afar and decrypt it and not even like appear on the network. I mean, a network mm-hmm. admin would have no idea that this is happening. So that's really kind of scary. It always makes me wonder how long have these vulnerabilities been known by bad guys or the good guys that are you know, using it in other ways. I've introduced some conspiracy theories recently. I'll spare you guys from that again. But yeah, it just makes me wonder, you know, when they're discovered, they're always, it's like, wow, how lucky that somebody figured this out. And like, I wonder how long this has been going on. Pepin, it's sad to say goodbye to you, but we've got to wrap up the show. Your wealth of knowledge around security, and really appreciate sharing a little bit of your story with us. We should definitely direct listeners to the Mac Admins podcast specifically. If you're not already in the Slack, check that out as well. You can hear more from Pepin on the Mac Admins podcast. And I think you can get to the Mac Admins Slack at macadmins.org. The podcast, podcast.macadmins.org.
Yeah, that's right. If you go to macadmins.org, there's a sign up. You can sign up for the Slack, and then podcast.macadmins.org. That's the home for all things Mac Admins podcast. You can listen to all episodes, all that good stuff.
Wonderful.
You know, so go there.
Excellent. Well, we really appreciate you joining us, Pepin. Pepin Brienne, R&D engineer with Duo Security. And we wish you the best of luck out there, keeping us secure and helping improve the security of our devices and our connections in the future. So thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.